Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Sigeri. Vermont Viewpoint is getting out and broadcasting at wonderful spots around the state as part of WDEV's 90th anniversary. And this morning, it's our fifth stop on the tour after visits to Cabot, Waitsfield, Randolph, and Elmore. This morning, I'm of Joe's Pond in West Danville at the Hastings store. And we'll spend the next couple hours talking about the store and ice out, food, of course, the railroad station, the library. And normally I share historical tidbits of a town, but I don't stand a chance finding anything that a couple of our guests that we'll hear from later haven't already uncovered and written about in a history of this town and village. So I'll leave it to them. But let's get this show rolling by meeting the owner of the Hastings store, Jenny Rayfuse. Jenny, thanks for being on the show and for allowing us to invade the store this morning.
Not a problem. We appreciate you being here.
You are the busiest person in Joe's Pond in West Danville throughout the morning. I've been watching you run around taking care of all these wonderful customers.
I try. It keeps me out of trouble.
Give us a little history. How far back can we go to trace the history of the Hastings store?
Well, the building was actually built in 1853, and Jenny and Gilbert Hastings bought it in 1913. And has been passed down for four generations. So I'm the fourth generation of the family.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah.
I see you have the picture of the original postmaster there.
Yes.
That's pretty great. And I saw a great picture online, I think it was on your Facebook page, of one of the owners back in like maybe the 40s using the old phone.
Yep, that was my great-grandfather, Gilbert.
No kidding. Oh, wow.
And then we had Ralph and Mabel, which is Jenny and Gilbert's son, took it over, and then my mom and dad took it over.
Wow. How long have you been running it?
3 years.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Oh, so you're a newbie.
I'm still a spring chicken here.
Well, you run around here and greet customers like you know every single one of them, so I'm sure that comes from living here a long time.
Yep.
Yeah. And give us just a kind of a wee tour of the store and some of the things people will find here.
So we have the post office, obviously. You'll see it right when you walk in. And then delicious baked goods on our counter and our table. And then we have coffee and, of course, our new, air quote, hardware section, which is the liquor store,
yes,
802 Spirits. And then you have the soda cooler, milk cooler, beer and wine, all right in that section at the end.
I did walk back to see what hardware was there and found some wonderful scotches and some great Vermont liquors. So it is great. To if you need some of your 802 spirits, this is a place to stop in for.
Oh, absolutely, yes.
I love it. And tempt us with some of the lunch and dinner specials that people will find here.
Okay, so we have... Today we have the corned beef and cabbage meal with,
of course,
obviously cabbage, potatoes, carrots, onions, turnip. And then we do beef pot roast with potato and a vegetable, pork roast, potato and vegetable. We're big on potato and vegetables.
Absolutely.
We do shepherd's pie, chicken and biscuits, lasagna, meatball subs. We try to give a wide variety of different homemade food.
That's nice. And you talked about the baked goods. I'm pretty sure people just flock here for the pies. Tell us, and is it pie day today?
Today is pie day. Don's out back whipping up the pie crust and the pie.
Donuts.
And our donuts.
You got a donut fan behind us there.
Oh, we have a lot of donut fans. So she's making the homemade pies today, berry pies, apple pies, all the different kinds of pies. And then we do our donuts every morning. We just had our second donut guest winner. So,
oh, yeah. Tell us about that. This is great stuff.
So the donut guests, we did how many donuts from January 1st to May 31st was our first section.
How many donuts you've made here in the store?
Right, by hand.
Yeah.
Which was 8,640.
Oh, my.
And we had a huge response to that, and all the money was going towards the toy run, the Shriners toy run with a motorcyclist. And then we did for the whole year, so January 1st to December 31st, and we just calculated the winner, who's Mike Barrett. He's from Connecticut, but has property up here in Vermont, and we had 26,580 handmade donuts.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, so we sell a few.
Yeah, you do. That is so great. I love what, and now every time you make a donut, is somebody back there doing a little tick
Me.
Mark?
Because I'm making the donuts, I'm making the tick marks.
So we can say that they're quite accurate, the totals. I love that it comes out to the donut. Yeah. All right. Now, this location is wonderful, right on Route 2, really advantageous to draw people, stop on trips between Montpelier and St. Jay, I would imagine. Who else comes into the store?
You got
the summer crowd, right?
We do. Our population triples in the summer.
Triples.
So we have around 300, 350 camps around the pond. And there is actually a dock between the junction of 2 and 15. So if you're at camp, you don't have to get in your car, dressed up, whatever. You can just jump in the boat, come on down, come across the street.
Right.
So we have all sorts of people. Other than that, we have traveling nurses coming in. We have a lot of Airbnbs around here, so we try to help accommodate everyone's food habits.
I love it. Now, let's talk about ice out, which is a real thing here at Joe's Pond. For those who don't know what an ice out is, first of all, explain what that's all about.
So the ice out began before I was around.
Mm-hmm.
So what it is they have a wood pallet with a cement block, which is attached to a rope, which is attached to a clock.
Mm-hmm.
So when the cement block goes down through the ice, it pulls the electric from the clock so that we know what time it goes out. So because of COVID, the price of our fireworks have gone up, which is what pays for the fireworks, the ice out. Half the money will go to the fireworks and for the to buy the supplies for next year's ice out tickets, and the other half goes to the winner. So we've been really pushing the ice out tickets this year so that we can have some nice fireworks still.
Oh, nice.
But, I mean, I think last year the winner got just over $6,000.
No kidding.
And for a buck a ticket, it's better than, you know, buying a Megabucks ticket at this point.
It sure is. I've got one right here. I can't wait to fill it out. And it tells you the recent wins. So the last 3 years, April 10th last year, April 15th the year before, even the time, but April 25th. And, yeah, 50% after expenses goes to the winner, 50% to Joe's Pond Activities Fund. I do like this provision. If the equipment fails, it's the committee's decision final as to exact time that they can calculate it having fallen through. And you don't – like it was just set up, wasn't it, the block and everything? When did somebody go out and do that?
I want to say it's set up around the end of the month.
Yeah.
I'm not 100% sure that it's set up yet.
Oh, okay. So
– but because it doesn't go out usually until the end of April,
right,
mid to end of April, you don't want people out there fooling around with it.
Gotcha. You can buy – you can get your ticket in and be entered by what, April 1st?
April 1st is your deadline.
Yeah.
So even if you mail them in, they don't get here. As long as they're post-dated, like your taxes,
right.
April 1st.
Got to get that postmark.
That's right.
All right. And it's just a dollar. If somebody can't make it in here, I think your winner was like from Connecticut or somewhere. How do they
You can also
enter?
Purchase them online with from the Joe's Pond Association website, or you can call and have them mailed to you. We'll take your money from a credit card over the phone and then put the cash in the ice out bag.
Now, I see this one's, they're all numbered. This is 5,200, so you do sell quite a few. And I would imagine we can purchase more than one. Is that correct?
You can purchase more than one, and they are available at other businesses.
Mm-hmm.
Also, everyone on the pond gets their allotment to sell.
Oh, really?
So
yeah.
we really try to boost the prize and the fireworks at the same time.
Oh, I love it. It's going to be a big celebration this year. Joe's Pond Association is joespondvermont.com. So if you can't get into Hastings store or one of the other locations where they're available, you can go to joespondvermont.com or call the Hastings store here and they'll send them out to you. I just love it. Jenny Rayfuse is the owner of the Hastings store, fourth generation here in West Danville. We're going to check back in with Jenny at the end of the morning if she's still speaking to me. And we're going to take a break now, and hopefully, I don't see Toby yet, but hopefully we'll talk about the state's longest running wild game supper. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. And we're back on Vermont Viewpoint. We are live from the Hastings store on Route 2 in West Danville this morning. And we are a few hundred feet from some great ice fishing at Joe's Pond. Toby, is that you? All right, come on over. It's time that we're going to meet the man who feeds many people in the area with wonderful wild game pies every November. He's also the person I'll need to keep on retainer in case I get into any legal trouble before I leave town. Have a seat here, Toby. It's Toby Balavay, and he's just pulling in. So can you get in there? I'm going to put you on this headset right here. And there we go. Say hello, Toby.
Hello.
All right. Toby, you Danvillean? Are you born and bred here in Danville?
No, I was born in D.C.
Oh.
1948. My parents were going back and forth between Danville and Arlington, Virginia, and I was a fall baby, so I was born down there.
Oh, no kidding. Well, do you remember your first wild game supper here in Danville?
The first time I went to the supper may have been the first time I worked on it, which would have been about the fall of 76, 78, sometime.
Wow. Now, for those who've never been, explain what people will enjoy at these suppers every November.
Well, it's our menu is basically it's a pie menu.
Mm-hmm.
It's a chicken pie recipe modified for game. So whatever game we have, we always hope to have venison, bear, rabbit, and coon would be the most traditional meats.
At times you've had beaver, moose and elk, I think.
We've had moose. We don't expect moose again for a while. Wild turkey.
Oh, yeah.
Wild turkey. And chicken for people who don't love game suppers but love someone who does.
That's right.
Okay.
I love that you have that kind of fallback in case someone just isn't ready for a bear pie. Where and when is it usually held, Toby?
It's the Thursday before Thanksgiving at the Danville Methodist Church.
Mm-hmm. And this year it was drive-through. It was a bit rainy, but the food was still wonderful. In non-pandemic years, explain what happens when people first arrive at the church.
Okay. For 2 years, we've done a pure drive-through before that and hope to return to sittings at 5, 6, and 7. And while they're waiting, they sit upstairs in the sanctuary and listen to bluegrass music.
It's fabulous.
Live.
Yeah, then you're told, okay, 5 o'clock seating, come on down. You come down the stairs and you're greeted by...
Well, sometimes me, but your ticket gets collected and you go through a double buffet line. It's basically all you can eat.
Yeah.
Most people don't abuse that privilege.
Right.
You may take a little of each one and or a whole lot of one or two.
Yeah, the different pies, and then you sit down and family style.
Yep.
And then great dessert pies as well afterwards.
And the usual vegetable sides tend to be glazed carrots, mashed potatoes, squash with maple syrup and butter in it, and sometimes cut green beans, cranberry sauce, sometimes coleslaw.
It is
quite a lot of sides.
Yeah, quite a lot of sides.
Yeah.
This great game supper. Where does the wild game come from?
Almost anywhere, and it ebbs and flows over the years, but it's become increasingly difficult. It's it tends to be donated game.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, wherever we can find it. Sometimes I'll have a trapper who will get me a steady supply of coon and beaver. But at the moment, we're kind of free and loose on that.
Mm-hmm. Are you a hunter? Do you ever bring anything in for the supper?
The last time I pulled the trigger on the family Model 94 3030 was at dusk when I was 17 years old. And I was shaking so hard, I don't think I hit anything.
So you're part of the whole equation.
I would go back to hunting if I needed to provision the supper.
Yeah, it is really fabulous. Do you have a favorite of the wild game pies?
Of the big game meats, my absolute favorite is bear.
Mm-hmm.
Deer and moose tend to be lean and dry. Bear has enough fat content to sometimes it tastes like beef. It can taste like beef burgundy.
Yes. Now, I will say, though, you know, the venison pies you had this year were outstanding. But your bear pie, I tell people, it tastes like the richest roast beef you've ever had in your life. It is that phenomenal. And I believe the first time I ever spoke to you was back in 2009. I came and did a piece and interviewed you. And I asked you what the key to preparing bear perfectly, as well as it is these bear pies that you have here at the Danville Supper. So what is the key?
I don't know what I told you.
I think I remember.
Well, you can tell me after I tell
right.
you. I have a confession to make. There's basically two kinds of game recipes. You can either let the game meat be what it is,
mm-hmm.
or you can treat it as the stone in a stone soup,
mm-hmm.
Which is kind of the way we do it. We throw the meat into a pot of water with carrots, mushrooms, onions, garlic, a whole bunch of stuff.
Yeah.
What we're really doing is making the gravy for the pie.
Yeah.
You slow cook it for a couple of hours till the meat falls off the bone. You take the meat out, you put the pot back on the stove, and you keep reducing it.
Mm.
1 year, we added an ingredient, and everybody's saying, what did you do to the gravy? And I forgot. I said, I didn't think we did anything to the gravy. But what we'd done is we'd added box wine. And that just added another layer of flavor. But anyways, you reduce the gravy to not thick, but rich.
Yeah, yeah.
The day of the supper, we assemble the pies. We've bagged and picked over and refrigerated the meat. We lay that in the pie pans. We warm up the gravy and thicken it a little,
mm-hmm.
typically with flour, and slosh that in, and then we've got a from-scratch pie crust that we lay over the top, and then we bake it.
It is delicious.
So what did I tell you the secret?
Well, you said that you had a guy who field-dresses the bear, and that has to be done properly to make sure that the bear...
Still got him. I'm hoping he won't retire.
Good job.
Exactly how we need to have it cut up.
Yeah.
On the bone is the way we prefer to cook it, and if we get marrow bones, you get a little bit with bear and deer. You get a lot with moose because they got bigger bones.
Mm-hmm.
But the marrow bones, you throw them into the pot because they'll thicken the gravy.
How many tickets do you normally sell? I think you sell out every year when you have the limited amount, you know, for
it
different
varies.
Meetings.
We could, we usually serve between 125 and 175. We could serve up to 300, but 1 year we did that years ago, and we were all exhausted.
Yeah, it takes an awful lot of work. The last time I was there, when it was inside, sat with a couple from New York City. Their son, they had called him in sick. for school that day. But they were driving back that night, and he had to go to school the next day. That was part of the deal. He was going to be dead tired, but he said it was absolutely worth coming up for that Thursday night feast. They absolutely loved it.
I've spent years kind of analyzing the market for the supper, and I think back in the 20s when it started, it was simply a community dinner, and our social structure tended to be local-oriented up until we hit the 50s. It'd be the local community that would come out for the dinner. Now I think it's people that specialize in game dinners and look for it online. One year I started collecting tickets, and the first person that came through was a woman from southern New Hampshire. But she'd driven up, she'd gone from southern New Hampshire down to Cape Cod, and then driven up to the supper and was going to drive home afterwards.
Well worth it. Toby Balavay is an attorney at Reed and Balavay Attorneys, and he's the chief cook and bottle washer of the Danville Game Supper. Toby, it's great having you on the show.
Thank you.
And we're going to take a break for a CBS News update, and then we're going to get a wonderful history lesson about Danville. And coming up today at noon, listen to the afternoon news service with Lee Cattell and Brady Farkas. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Warren Village is a picture-perfect snow globe this time of year. We invite you to visit us at the almost world-famous Warren store. Come for breakfast, lunch, or après-ski. Have a signature deli sandwich, a hearty soup, or a specialty coffee drink paired with a sweet treat from our incredible bakery. Upstairs is a cornucopia of delightful and unique finds from men's, women's, and children's clothing to gifts, toys, games, jewelry, hats, gloves, and scarves. Best one-stop shopping in Vermont, according to Yankee Magazine. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
We're back on Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV from the Hastings store at Joe's Pond in West Danville. Sometimes in the hunt for the perfect guests, it's better to be lucky than to be good. I thought it would be great to find someone for this show who could talk about Danville's favorite son, Thaddeus Stevens. Several phone calls later, I'm speaking with Patty Conley of the Danville Historical Society, and she says, well, Jane Brown and I have written a book about the history of Danville and the surrounding area. And thus, I have Patty and Jane, authors of West Danville, Vermont, Then and Now, 1781 to 2021. Hi to both of you. Welcome to the store. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having us, Rick.
And a quick note, the book is for sale here at the Hastings store at Joe's Pond. Patty, the title is a little bit of a misnomer. What area, it's West Danville, Vermont, but what area does the book cover?
Well, it certainly covers West Danville, Vermont very thoroughly, but in the process, it also has a lot of Danville history, as well as Cabot, Barnett,
Marshfield, Walden,
all the surrounding towns. And it also pulls in a little bit of history throughout the country, depending on the time period that we're talking about.
And talking about time period, it was done in a blink of an eye. How long did it take you to research and write the book?
A blink of an eye. Well, I wouldn't quite say that, Rick. from the date of our very first meeting in 2013 until 2021, when the book finally was published in December, it was about 8 years of research.
Almost to the day.
Writing.
Well, I'll tell you, it's getting rave reviews here in the store. This morning I've already had two people come in and say how much they've enjoyed it. One, a history teacher here in town. So
wonderful.
You're getting very positive reviews. So the book was published in December, and Jane, you had two others who worked with you during the process of putting this book together.
Yes. Dottie Ayer Larrabee, passed away in the spring before the book was published, and it was a great loss to us. But Dottie wrote a great deal about the town because she grew up here. And also Jane Hastings Larrabee, who, of course, had roots here at Hastings Store, and her family had been here for well over 100 years. And she had a wealth of information for us. And while she didn't do any of the actual writing, she provided a lot of facts and her grandmother's diaries and a wealth of pictures. And and information, and she was a great storyteller. So we were able to capture some of her stories, too.
How fantastic. So let's go back, Judy, to 1781, because the book covers from 1781 to 2021. What was special about that date? What would this area have looked like back then?
Well, the area was unpopulated, completely unpopulated, until the military road, the Bailey-Hazen military road, came through. And as the road progressed north, of course, they were headed for Canada originally and never made it. They had offshoots, and people would explore as they went along. And Jesse Leavenworth, who figured a great deal in the Cabot settlement, wandered off this direction, found what we now know as Joe's Brook and the pond, and thought, gee, that would be a great place to put a mill. And so he settled here, thinking he was in the town of Cabot. And a few years later, when they had a chance to survey it properly, and Cabot was getting their boundaries and their town line settled, along with Danville and Peacham and so forth, for a long time it was Deweysburg. That because they really didn't know where the town lines were, and but it finally turned out that he was in the town of Danville.
All right, and Jane, I'll try to remember that that's your name and not Judy.
That's all right. I answer to anything. To
I can tell I got it wrong by the look on your face. Patty, what kind of records were you able to find about Danville from that time, that late 18th century, early 19th century?
Well, it's amazing. We used a wealth of resources, from gazetteers to historical newspapers, the old North Star that was published out of Danville for many years up until 1889, when the office was destroyed by a big fire that wiped out most of Danville. Archives of the Caledonian Record and other area newspapers. We did some oral histories on a few people. In fact, originally we thought about doing a book with just oral histories,
sure,
until we realized that a lot of the people that we really needed to talk to were no longer with us.
Wow.
So, but so yeah, we had a lot of different resources that we were able to use.
All right. Now, I'd ask who Dan was, Jane, but I know that would be a bit cheeky. Where did the name Danville come from?
Oh, I think I should pass that off to Patty. I'm not a,
you know,
I'm
that,
not
Patty?
A Danville historian.
General D. Danville, D apostrophe A-N-V-I-L-L-E, mm-hmm, was where the name originated from, and I believe it was a Canadian name, obviously, a French pronunciation.
Someone who spent time here? Or?
You know, I don't really know. I think he was an early explorer,
yeah,
and that's about all I can tell you about that.
All right. But what kind of industry would we have seen throughout maybe the 1800s here in Danville? Because it certainly was quite active.
Well, Danville was the county seat for quite a while. Mm-hmm. And then once the county seat finally moved to St. Johnsbury, it kind of changed the dynamics of the industry in town. And at one point, it was claimed that sheep were more prevalent than people in Danville. So sheep farming was very, very popular. There were a lot of woolen mills, grist mills, bobbin mills, as there were in West Danville. West Danville also had a granite industry.
Really?
As well. Yeah, there were several granite sheds that were located on the beach along Joe's Pond. And then, of course, when the railroad came in, they were able to transport these big granite monuments and stones and things to a greater distance. And
is there a granite quarry around here? Or
yes, there is.
Yeah.
There's what used to be Fry's Granite Quarry, which is on Route 2 between West Danville and Danville. And there was also a small quarry on the Cabot side of Joe's Pond that was opened up. That was opened up, I think, in the early 1900s. But it was a thriving business. They had polishing shops here, and as well as granite sawing quarries that dealt with the the raw stones. And but that mainly was after the railroad came through, wasn't it, Patty?
Yes. Mm-hmm. But before, there were several lumber mills as well. And again, right. Lumber was transported by rail once the railroad finally came through.
And when would that have
been? Sawmills. The railroad came through in Danville in 1871.
Oh, okay.
So, and then gradually made its way through to West Danville and then on through eventually all the way to Swanton.
So what else stands out, Patty, about Danville in those formative years, say, between the 1780s and 1880s?
Well, there's the schools. The Peacham had a primary school, actually, and then there was the academy there in Danville, which was
Phillips
the secondary
academy.
School, and all of the towns in the general area had their own schools, one-room schools, usually.
I've noticed when you come through Danville, you know, you can start at pre-K, so preschool, and I believe on Route 2 you can go all the way from pre-K, and then at the other end in Burlington you could wind up going to grad school. So you could, on Route 2 through Vermont,
that's interesting.
Spend your entire educational career here.
And I think probably some people have, in fact, done that.
I think so, too.
And then, of course, in the other direction, it's a little off Route 2, but we've got, you know, Northern Vermont University, which was previously Linden State College and Linden Teachers College.
Yeah. So.
But St. Johnsbury Academy also figured heavily into the secondary schooling because the grading was a little bit different back in the 1700s, 1800s, they had a different system, and that didn't get normalized until probably the early 1900s, and they also introduced a lot of other things like medical assistance for kids that needed it, and it was interesting that the town kept a record of the children that were, how was it they put that, It was something that would not be acceptable to say today, but it was like saying they were deformed. They were somehow
special needs.
Special needs children, but they didn't put it quite that way.
Yeah, interesting. You've covered 240 years. When we come back, we're going to talk about some of the interesting personalities from the area. We're going to take a break and then return to chat with historians Jane Brown and Patty Conley. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
The WDEV studio is sponsored by Sticks and Stuff and Swanton Lumber, Vermont's largest independent home center. Go to sticksandstuff.com for store locations and hours.
Mihuron's Market is fully open to serve you. Shop brand new produce cases brimming with fresh local and organic fruits, vegetables, greens, and more. Choose a handcrafted sandwich from the deli or a delicious entree from their hot foods bar. And from skilled butchers and fishmongers, you'll find the highest quality meat and seafood available. Additional sanitizing and cleaning procedures throughout the store will keep you safe. Face covering for all shoppers is encouraged. Disposable masks and gloves are provided for added protection. Mihuron Supermarket, Main Street, Waitsfield.
This is Dr. Grace Johnstone from Hyperbaric Vermont, a nonprofit with treatment centers in Montpelier and South Burlington. When I was suffering with Lyme disease, meningitis, and unable to even walk, Hyperbaric is what allowed me to recover when other treatment methods failed. Determined to learn more, I became certified in hyperbaric medicine and founded Hyperbaric Vermont. Our mission is to raise awareness of the benefits of hyperbaric oxygen therapy, or HVOT, and to make this life-changing treatment accessible to others. How does it work? The increased pressure of the hyperbaric chamber oxygenates all the fluid in your body, perfusing all of your cells and organs with high levels of oxygen. Increased pressure and oxygen have a powerful anti-inflammatory effect, speed tissue healing, and are a natural antimicrobial. Research and clinical experience show that hyperbaric can be effective in treating Lyme, arthritis, stroke, dementia, chronic fatigue, non-healing wounds, traumatic brain injury, and long COVID symptoms, among other things. To learn more about hyperbaric oxygen therapy, visit our website at hyperbaricvermont.org.
Ski and ride for free this spring at Sugarbush Resort. 2022-23 season passes are now on sale for the lowest prices of the year. Make Sugarbush your home base next winter with a variety of pastimes and options to meet you and your family's skiing and riding needs. Plus, with two access roads and mountain areas, you'll spend more time skiing and less time waiting. Are you a current 2021-22 pass holder? Take advantage of special renewal discounts when you buy now. Not only will you save big, but both Icon and Sugarbush passes offer a wide range of winter and summer resort benefits. Sugarbush's legendary terrain makes it a perfect launching pad for Icon passes 49 other worldwide destinations. To learn more and purchase your season pass, visit sugarbush.com.
Spring is a great time to visit Sugarbush Resort with skiing and riding through early May. Ski free from now until the end of the season when you buy your 22-23 season pass. Learn more at sugarbush.com.
Coming up today on the Brady Farkas Show, it's finally game day. The NCAA tournament has started. We take you through what happened in the early games, and then we continue to get you ready for UVM men's basketball. Catamounts taking on Arkansas. 13-seeded Cats looking for the upset of the 4th-seeded Razorbacks. We get the final word on Arkansas from one last Razorbacks insider and what's happening in Major League Baseball. The hot stove is a-churning. You'll hear from Buster Olney of ESPN as well. Brady Farkas Show today, 5:30 on DEV.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Sangari. We're at the Hastings store in West Danville this morning as part of the WDEV 90th anniversary tour. Our next stop in a couple weeks will be in Stowe, but this morning we're learning all about the history of Danville from the women who wrote the book on it, Patty Conley and Jane Brown, who have just become my new favorite guests of all time. I'll explain in a moment. Jane, who are some interesting residents of the town or area in say the 1700s, 1800s, through the 1900s. You can pick out one or two that you enjoyed writing about in the book. You only have 240 years to sift through to come up with an answer on that question.
One of the most popular ones, of course, is Indian Joe.
Mm-hmm.
And he did exist. There are a lot of stories about him, but we tried to sift through and find more facts than fiction. And there have been a lot of fables written about him and so forth. But he was here, he and his wife. And, of course, Molly's Pond was named for her, and Joe's Pond for Joe. And other than that, who else would be?
I would say Charles Brainerd. Obvious one would be Thaddeus Stevens, who was born in Danville. His family lived in Danville, and then eventually his mother, Sally Morrill Stevens, wanted her children to go to Peacham Academy, which had been designated as the high school at that point in time, or Caledonia Grammar School, as it was called then. So they moved to Peacham, and Thaddeus attended Caledonia Grammar School and ended up graduating from, I believe he went to Dartmouth, and then, of course, he ended up being in the Congress. So he was one of our more famous citizens from Danville.
Yeah, really rose to acclaim in Pennsylvania.
In Pennsylvania area.
Right.
Exactly. Charles Brainerd was one of the real benefactors of the town of Danville. He contributed a lot of money to establish a library in North Danville. He contributed money for the high school in Danville and other community organizations as well. So he was a very noteworthy Danville person as well.
All right.
We should mention also that the state's smallest library is located here in West Danville, and it's the Charles E. Brainerd Library.
I spotted it when I was out checking the ice.
Yeah.
I'm trying to figure out ice out. But it is a wee library.
That was originally a gas station here in West Danville.
Wow.
And there were five gas stations here. And that was in probably the 20s or 30s. And that was one of them. And it was right up on the corner as you head over the bridge, heading out of town towards Montpelier.
Yeah.
And they moved that and made it into a little library. And Jenny Refuse's mother was about 11 years old at the time. and that it was first set up, and she was the librarian.
Oh, how great.
And for quite a number of years, and she remained a trustee until she turned it over to the town to support. And then it was dormant pretty much for quite a number of years, and then some Joe's Pond people decided that it should be renovated, and they did that about 5 or 6 years ago.
Good for them.
It's a beautiful little place now.
I love it. Now, Patty, I understand that you sorted through a lot of photographs as you researched the book. How many? Where'd they come from? And then how did you decide what you were going to put in the book? I can tell why it took 8 years.
Yeah. Well, we were very fortunate in that we had a wonderful collection of glass plate negatives that was donated to the Danville Historical Society by an early photographer who started taking pictures in the late 1800s up into the early 1900s. And those were all done on glass plate negatives and of very high quality. And they were all of Danville people, places, but there were a number from West Danville as well. It was mostly Danville and West Danville. And his name was Harold Hatch. And his grandson, Kevin Ayer, shared that collection with us and actually turned it over to us. And so all of those nearly 2,000 glass plate negatives have been transposed into digital format, and they're just wonderful, and they produce beautifully. So those were a great number of the photos that we used, other than ones that were part of the Historical Society collection already, and then other people, as we went along and researched, shared photos with us as well. We scanned them and returned them. Other people just donated them to our collection. Some are more recent photographs. They're not all historical photographs. Some are more recent of the camps on Joe's Pond and people. And it was very difficult. We ended up with, oh gosh, probably 800 photos, and we had to narrow it down to, there's probably 500 photos in the book, would you say, Jane?
Wow.
I would guess.
Yeah.
And all captioned.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah.
So, Jane, what do you think stands out about the history of this area? You looked at 240 years of what happened here. So what would you say really kind of is a reason you'd write a book about it?
The community itself, of course, we concentrated on West Danville. But in order to do that, we had to include a lot about the surrounding towns because they were very much a part of living in those days. But it was the whole community was very representative of what was going on. They reflected the politics, of course, of the state as things happened. They reacted the same as everybody else, pretty much. They were independent, and it was basically a farm community always. But, of course, there were these people that weren't content, like Mr. Hatch, who had a yen to be a photographer, and so he just went out and took a lot of pictures. And other people who designed a millstone or something unusual, and they just did these things. The Brainerd Library was set up because a farmer had extra money that he wanted to be sure meant something to the community. And those are the kinds of things. And they had their ups and downs, just like everybody else. They had their drunks. They had their brawls. They had prohibition with fast black cars going through the community and hiding in a garage here in town, and all kinds of things that were happening everywhere, but they happened here.
Yeah.
And we dug through them. And
now,
found it.
When we've talked, Patty, about the Danville of old and all the industry that was going on here, I come to Danville now, and it's not that industrial center. It's quieted down quite a bit, and we only have a couple minutes left, but when did that fade away? When did Danville become a little bit more of a quieter community and not have all that industrial activity?
Well, I think it kind of switched to more of a farming agrarian culture.
Yeah.
And after the railroad went out, that made a huge difference because all of a sudden there was no more passenger travel and there wasn't a way to transport freight any longer from Danville. There was still grain that came in, a certain amount of freight and different things that were shipped from Danville. But then after the railroad closed, it really changed all of those things. But now, of course, with the rail trail, the Lamoille Valley Rail Trail, taking over the rail bed that was formerly the P&O Railroad or the St. Johnsbury and Lake Champlain, St. Johnsbury and Lamoille County Railroad, now that's going to bring another whole culture of travelers through Danville, being on bicycles, snowmobiles, cross-country skis, walkers, horseback riding. So that's kind of exciting.
You also need to remember that it turned into, with the coming of the railroad, it turned into a playground for summer people,
yeah,
too. And that settled down after a few years, and it didn't turn into a typical resort area. It's more of a community all in itself.
Yeah, great point, Jane. I will explain now why Jane and Patty are two of my favorite guests ever. When I asked which was the authority on Thaddeus Stevens, they each pointed at the other person. Jane Brown and Patty Conley are the authors of West Danville, Vermont, Then and Now, 1781 to 2021. It's available here at the Hastings store on Route 2 at Joe's Pond. Patty and Jane, thank you so much for being on this morning.
Thank you for having us, Rick.
Let's take a break, and then we'll have the top of the hour CBS News, and then come back to the Hastings store when we'll learn about Danville's Jewel on the Green, the Pope Memorial Library. And a reminder that coming up today at 1, we've got 3 full hours of the Getaway with Greg Hooker. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Warren Village is a picture-perfect snow globe this time of year. We invite you to visit us at the almost world-famous Warren store. Come for breakfast, lunch, or après-ski. Have a signature deli sandwich, a hearty soup, or a specialty coffee drink paired with a sweet treat from our incredible bakery. Upstairs is a cornucopia of delightful and unique finds from men's, women's, and children's clothing to gifts, toys, games, jewelry, hats, gloves, and scarves. Best one-stop shopping in Vermont, according to Yankee Magazine. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
We're back on Vermont Viewpoint, live from the Hastings store, located hard by Joe's Pond on Route 2 in West Danville. Probably one of the most recognizable general stores in the state, because you always respectfully slow down as you go by, out of consideration for those crossing over from the parking lot to the store. Next up, as we get a picture of this wonderful Vermont town, we're going to spend time at its beautiful library. With me is the director of the Pope Memorial Library, Shara McCaffrey. Shara, thanks for being here.
Thank you for inviting us.
And we've got Dee Palmer, the assisting director of the library. Dee, great having you here as well.
Thank you.
All right. Now, first of all, Dee, give us a description of that Pope Library building.
It's a beautiful, beautiful building, right on the green, right across from the town hall. They call it the Jewel on the Green because the architecture is so beautiful, and it has beautiful Palladian windows, and in the summer, our gardens are incredible, tended to by Robin Rothman, who is an artist, and she's an artist in the garden as well. It's just a beautiful spot inside and out.
Was it built, Shara, as a library? Was it someone's home to begin with?
No, it was built actually as a library. The original library was housed in a brick building, which burned, and the fire burned quite a bit of the business district of the town of Danville, and it was advertised in the papers, and a woman in Chicago, Mrs. Charles Pope, heard about the fire. Her husband grew up in Danville, and so she asked her solicitors, you know, she wanted to help in some way, and they recommended that she donate enough money to have the library rebuilt.
Oh, my goodness. What a wonderful story. And when would that have been?
It was done, I believe, dedicated in 1890. The fire was in 1886.
Yeah. Any idea who gave it that moniker, the Jewel of the, on the Green?
I'm really not sure. It's just, you know, kind of a given.
Yeah. Now you just accept it. It's a beautiful building, beautiful space.
Mm-hmm.
And how long have you been associated with the library?
22 years.
That's quite some time.
Yep.
So why has this been such a special place for you to be part of for that long?
It feels like my home away from home. And I started as the children's librarian, and now I've come full circle, and I'm back doing children's stuff. And when I was a children's librarian, all the kids thought that that was my house.
Oh,
and,
wow.
You know, so I try to explain it to them. And so, yeah, it's just, it's a great place to see people and just, you know, well, a friend of mine used to say that I had my hand on the pulse of the community.
Mm-hmm.
So you just know everything that's going on. And if people have questions about pretty much anything, they'll come to us. And if we don't know, we can figure it out. And not just about books, about anything concerning Danville and beyond.
How has the library changed in those 22 years that you've been associated with it?
A lot of changes. You know, we used to write people's library numbers on cards and file them, and instead of having all the catalog information on the computer, we would have cards that we'd also have to file in the card catalog, you know, with headings and subjects and how to find what you were looking for. So now we've been completely automated for quite a while, and we have two access computers and Wi-Fi inside and out of the building. So just, you know, like the rest of the world, we've...
Still using the Dewey Decimal System?
Oh, yes.
All right, good. That's the important part.
Yep.
Shara, what do you do at Pope to make sure that you're still serving the community of Danville?
I need to interject here that my tenure is very young. I just started in December, and Dee was the director. So now she's my mentor. So I'm glad she's back. she retired, and now she's back. So we're doing this together.
All right. Cool.
So I am just getting to know the community. I do not live here, but I was amazed when I first started how many people who came into the building I knew, because in northeastern Vermont, people go to all the libraries, and I was in a library in St. Johnsbury, so many of those people came there as well. So it's
that the Athenaeum?
Yes, and it felt very much like home. But an entirely different setting.
Yeah.
So I am learning the associations, the businesses, and the people.
Yeah.
And they still come in. They still like to read books. They do anything from making copies to leaving things for us to give to somebody else who drops in later in the afternoon, leaving things outside the door for people to feed their goats, you name it. We're there for whatever anybody in the community needs.
I love it. How did the pandemic, affect, you know, when you were open, how people could access the library? Did it have a great impact on the Pope?
Pretty huge.
Yeah.
Yep. We actually, it was almost 2 years to the day. It was March 15th when we closed our doors and started to figure out how we were going to make it work. And so we all got on the library's email so we could get it at home, and people would email us or call us to request a book, and we took turns going into the library, and we'd get the books, and we set up a drop box, you know, pretty waterproof container that we would put the books in bags and with people's names on them, and they could come and pick up the books at any time. And so that was pretty, it was weird. It was very weird.
Yeah.
And but we did as much as we could from home, and the little amount of time that we spent individually in the library. And then little by little, we started to open up. We did it by appointment. Our hours were shortened. And then, you know, as time went on, we finally got back to being a regular library again.
Shara, what kind of outreach are you able to do to make sure that you're reaching readers of 2022?
A lot of it. Small towns, believe it or not, are word of mouth. But we do have a Facebook page. We do have a website, which I'm hoping is one challenge for me to grow it, to make it more interactive, more lively. And we are talking about that, where to go next. I think for me, getting to know the community a little bit more, and reaching out to organizations. We have ownership of a community center right behind our building that's being used for art classes and associations to meet. So it's a way of kind of getting to know them and seeing what their needs are. Having that building reaches people in a different way. But we do have books posted on the website. We just want to get it a little bit more interactive and maybe do more videos, Zooms to have book discussions so that it gets out to people out there in the world. And so that technology is something new for us, as it is, as it became for everybody, teachers, and so forth. So that's our goal.
All right. Dee, one final question I've got to ask. You might not know, but Danville had a U.S. senator and governor named William Palmer. That was back in the early 1800s. Any relation to the...
No relation, but he lived on our road.
Oh, my goodness.
We live on Greenbanks Hollow Road, and there's a house called the Governor Palmer House, and it's the second oldest house on our road.
And yep. Greenbanks Hollow, wasn't that little industrial center?
Yep, that burned down.
Oh, people should always drive down there.
Definitely.
And see that story.
Definitely.
Oh, another reason to come to the Danville area. Mm-hmm. That's Dee Palmer, also Shara McCaffrey of the Pope Memorial Library. It is the jewel on the green. And I want to thank you both for being on the show this morning.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
All right, we're going to take a break, and then we'll return to our live broadcast from Joe's Pond. Next up, we'll meet the creator of The Art of Eating magazine, Ed Baer. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. We're still here at the Hastings store on Route 2 in West Danville, right by Joe's Pond. One thing I love about Vermont is that foodies and gourmets around the globe turn to this little corner of Vermont to learn about the best. It's never been a fancy, frilly publication, but it's always filled with the finest in food, and it is The Art of Eating magazine. With me is the publisher, Ed Baer. Ed, welcome to the Hastings store at Vermont Viewpoint.
Hey, thank you.
All right. Now, Ed, how would you describe The Art of Eating magazine?
Oh, boy. Well, it's not that commercial, no ads. It's
right.
Very, well, serious sometimes to a fault. We try to be fun. We have recipes and so on. We do some restaurant reviews. We have in-depth pieces on regional cuisines, in-depth pieces on particular ingredients. I mean, not too long ago, I myself wrote an article in-depth on French shallots, and it turns out I knew there was something odd, but the ones in the store have changed over the years, and then there was another earlier one which had richer flavor and was a little better, and then dig deep enough, there's one that is very rare in this country, the gray shallot, which is grown in southwestern France, southern France, southeastern, southwestern, and that one is richer and better still, and then if you go back to the store one, you're like, whoa, this is just hot and just not interesting. But, of course, you have to grow the great one yourself, which I began to do.
Oh,
and,
well
and still
done.
Do.
And it's great that, like you said, there's no ads. But when you started, it was kind of, what, like a mimeograph sheet?
It was practical. No, it was printed. It was 8 pages. Printed. It was black and white. And the first issue was really homey. And when I look at it, I don't exactly feel visually proud of what it is visually.
But if people turn to it from around the world,
yeah,
right? Where do you? Well, now it's online, but where do you have subscribers?
Well, we figure this is a little bit going back to print because we haven't been as diligent about finding out where people are now, but
yeah.
20% abroad, and those tend to be English-speaking countries or outward-looking countries. I mean, we had a surprising number in South Korea, for instance, and still do.
Wow.
Yeah, they're just some certain small outward, you know, Australia is English-speaking, but relatively small population. We had quite a few Australians, for instance, when I last checked.
Well, Ed, who are you? I mean, why do people care about your, you know, what you know about food? Because they do. People around the world want to know. What does Ed Baer think?
Well, you know, it's probably because I'm so fanatical. You know, I went deep into shallots, and I just wrote, this is a super long dominant piece in the last issue about beef and climate, which really wasn't, usually we're about taste. It's like, okay, you know, personal enjoyment, whatever.
Right.
But this was about beef and climate, and I really dug in. I had 73, you know, in Word, 73 pages of source materials that I gathered. And I concluded that beef on grass, you know, grass-fed that we're all hearing a lot about, mm-hmm. is probably about on a par in terms of effect on climate with eating crops.
Oh, wow.
But so, you know, you can sign up and read my close almost 13,000 words on beef and climate if you have doubts.
The story is titled "The Accusation Against Beef," and yes, because cattle are taking a lot of heat about the creation of greenhouse gases.
Yeah, the UN and the EPA are saying something like 14% of greenhouse gases are coming from cattle. Basically belching, not so much coming out the far end, if you dig into the science. And it's because we all know cows are a big thing in Vermont. This is actually important to Vermont. 65% of our agriculture here in Vermont is still dairy, so it's the same issues as with beef. Now, I'm losing myself. I get so excited about my topic. But the fact is, so cows have four stomachs, right? They're ruminants. And cows eat grass. We can't eat grass because we have just one stomach and we can't handle it. So the cows eat the grass, and then they regurgitate it, in effect. They chew their cud, famously. And then they send it back down, and they fully digest the grass. So that's something. So you can... Grass is great stuff. It sequesters carbon. If you have permanent pastures, it does all these good things. And now they're beginning to measure what that carbon is and how it works, what the biological subterranean mechanisms are that get that carbon down there, which is a lot to do with the fungus that grows together symbiotically with the roots and the ends of the root hairs. And it's looking, nobody knows for sure. There's so many variables with agriculture. I mean, anybody in Vermont knows you've got valley farms, you've got hill farms, everything is different. But it looks as if right now probably their cattle, 100% on grass, are roughly on a par with crops.
Wow.
Not to dig too deep. We could go deeper.
But that's really important information.
It's hugely important for Vermont.
Love it. All right. How do you maintain the incredible standard that this magazine has set over, I think it's 36 years now?
You've done the math better. I try to forget sometimes.
I have.
Yeah, but it's me, probably. You know, the answer is that I'm the fanatic behind it, who just really cares about information, as you can probably tell by those 73 pages I mentioned. Mm-hmm. And I don't know exactly why, but I don't like to compromise. So it gets a lot of respect. We also run a book review, the Art of Eating Prize, for the best food book of the year. I always want to put best in quotes because what exactly does best mean?
Sure.
But we're the only food book award that gives away a substantial amount of money, which is $10,000 from our sponsors.
Wow.
And we also are the only book award where super knowledgeable judges get together and talk. Now, they talk via email exchanges, which actually in some ways is better. It's all about writing anyway, but then you can really follow the conversation. So that's another very serious thing we do. And you're saying, you know, ask people to be judges, and they almost always say yes, and they're top people.
Oh, that is fantastic. Now, another thing you've dug into are some high mountain cheeses of south central France. Another one of your...
Not obscure topics in France, but in this country a bit.
Yeah. So tell us what you've learned.
So this
was
a little bit at the same time I was digging into beef. I actually started earlier. But Salers cheese and Cantal. And those are cheeses that are actually, among French cheeses, the closest to cheddar, so people can relate to them, and it's because they're made in somewhat similar ways. But they are high mountain cheeses, and they're, you know, they're, I was talking with one guy, I'm forgetting exactly, but he was at 12 or 1,300 meters, you know, which is, I should know, but times three plus,
yeah.
39.34 inches to a yard. So it was fascinating. So there's if the purest version is Salers, and in Salers it's a raw milk cheese, and they make it in a wooden barrel which is full of this benign contamination of all the cultures that most Vermont cheesemakers would buy, or at least as a supplement, not all. It's got this benign contamination in the gerle, which is this wooden barrel they've been using. It has two little ears, and there's a pole, and you can move it, and that's where the curd is set. And that's so this is just ultra pure. It's all grass. It's way high in the mountains, so you have certain wild plants that dominate that contribute more interesting flavors, which come out during aging. And then I talked to an affineur, an ager guy in the little city there, Aurillac, and he's telling me about, all the colors, the yellow, the orange, the red, and I wasn't sure, and I came back to him, and I said, on a separate follow-up interview, and I said, you really meant red, right? He said, oh, yeah, red. That's the really good color that only shows up in the natural caves when you're doing the best Salers, and that's associated with the best flavor. So it's kind of wild stuff. It's fun.
It sounds fantastic. Now, you're right here in this area. I've wondered, I had this guy who everybody turns to, gourmets around the world, and I wondered, have you ever been to the Danville Wild Game Supper, the oldest in the state?
I have a long, long time ago. I remember bear. I'm trying to remember what I had, but yeah, I have a long time ago. I'm not the greatest not expert on the Danville Wild Game Supper, but
that's
I have
okay.
been.
All right, I just wanted to check to see if
I would recommend it for those who need to eat their yearly bear and venison and whatever.
I love going there. We've got a couple minutes left, but I do want to ask you your thoughts on the future of agriculture in Vermont. I know it's bigger than a two-minute answer,
another thing I've been fanatical on. So there was recently prepared for the governor by a commission that he appointed Future of Agriculture in Vermont report,
mm-hmm.
and there's some good things in it. It's about more carefully allocating some monies that were already out there. There's some good proposals, but I was especially concerned because they really didn't address dairy, because dairy has been going downhill probably since 1840, but dairy's been going downhill notably, and we've lost lots of farms in recent years, and they didn't really acknowledge that. They even were talking about ways to support more large farms. So, fewer larger farms are not necessarily better because you're concentrating the cattle, and they're certainly not out on grass because physically you can't get enough pastures close to a giant barn with 1,000 cows or whatever.
Right.
So this was very much an issue to me, and my hope is that there's a way. You need another fluid milk market. You got to get farmers out of the commodity market. They're just not being paid enough per hundredweight. They are right at this moment, but not generally. So my idea is to get some kind of a very ecological, grass-fed, green label for Vermont that the state would recognize and establish. And I don't want to pretend to say advise anything in particular. It doesn't, could be different separate dairies, could be all one. And that would be a new market for fluid milk that would go with the name Vermont blazoned on it, go throughout the Northeast. That would be my hope, because if you can't find another market, another major market for fluid milk besides commodity dairy in Vermont, is doomed to continue its slow decline until it presumably disappears altogether.
I'm going to name you my Secretary of Agriculture when I take over. Well done.
Thank you.
Ed Baer is the publisher of The Art of Eating magazine. You can find it at artofeating.com. I want to thank you so much for being here.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you, Rick, so much.
All right, we're going to take a break, and then we'll learn about the efforts to restore Danville's train station. And coming up today at 11 on WDEV, stay tuned for Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Warren Village is a picture-perfect snow globe this time of year. We invite you to visit us at the almost world-famous Warren store. Come for breakfast, lunch, or après-ski. Have a signature deli sandwich, a hearty soup, or a specialty coffee drink paired with a sweet treat from our incredible bakery. Upstairs is a cornucopia of delightful and unique finds from men's, women's, and children's clothing to gifts, toys, games, jewelry, hats, gloves, and scarves. Best one-stop shopping in Vermont, according to Yankee Magazine. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint, and welcome back to the Hastings store in West Danville, where we're broadcasting live this morning. Like so many towns in Vermont, Danville once was a stop on the railway and had its own station, and then cars, highways, train station abandoned. But there's a group working to bring the Danville train station back to life. And joining me now from the Danville Train Station Committee is Michael Hoag. Michael, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here with you.
Great having you. Let's talk a little bit about railroad history in Danville. When did it arrive? When did things really thrive because of the railroad?
That's really easy. 150 years ago.
Oh, okay.
We just had our 150th anniversary at the train station. Opened it up. It was set up beautifully. We had 100 people show up for it. It's right on the trail, which cuts just below the center of town, about a quarter of a mile down.
All right.
And it has been active pretty much the entire time, but the building is original. It's the only train station left that is original in its condition.
Oh, my.
And you wouldn't know it from all the peeling paint, and you wouldn't know it from the fact we use it as a recycle center, but it is truly an important asset to the town.
Well, let's talk first about train here in Vermont, including Joe's Pond. I think there was a station here
yes,
as well,
was.
Right? So what effect did the arrival of rail have on this area?
It was critical to the economy, and it turned out to the culture of the towns. The first train that left St. Jay, the St. Jay and LC line going to Swanton, its first stop was Danville. The station was finished about 3 hours before the train came. And because the train's never on time, they had a little extra time to, between St. Jay and Danville to get there. There's a legion of laughter and stories with the trail. And one of the highlights for me, and we have a team of 14 people that are just highly professional working on this, but the chairman emeritus is the guy who drove the trains. Archie Prevost. Archie is the most wonderful guy, and his stories about trying to get to Swanton from St. Johnsbury are just incredibly funny, cheerful. But it was the thing that got the grain, the lumber, the maple syrup, the milk out of Danville, out into the farther reaches, increased the economy dramatically. Passengers could get on the train, and they could make it all the way here to Joe's Pond. Took them an hour or two, but got all the way to Joe's Pond. And it sped up mail.
Yeah.
And then high-speed internet. The telegraph came in. And when Archie's train wasn't knocking down the telephone poles, we had continuous telegraph back and forth between the towns. It brought the towns together.
Yeah.
And for Danville, it was really an economic boost. And you can tell by some of these pictures I brought over here today, is that the community that was created, you know, the ability to go there to the train station, to wave at the train to come by, to swear at the train from dumping all the snow in your driveway that you had to dig out before you go to work in the morning. It was the heartbeat of Danville. It was really special.
What's your interest in restoring this train station?
I'm on the planning committee. We've been eyeing this station. We did a study 2 years ago, Better Connections, how to bring the towns all together better. It clearly pointed out that the train station was a hub, and it could be a hub again. With the completion of the LVRT, the Loyal Valley Rail Trail, the roadbed for 93 miles from St. Jay to Swan, at the end of this fall, that it could become a hub of activity again to bring people into Danville, to get them to go out into our economy, to spend money in Danville.
Yeah.
And same thing, it gets the people of Danville out in outdoor recreation. healthy, wellness. And it doesn't matter whether you're on a snow machine, whether you're mushing your dogs, or you're riding a horse, or you're cross-country skiing, or you're running or walking. There's a place for you out there.
Yeah.
And we got a health center close by just in case.
I love it. What will it take to restore this train station?
Well, we've been at this 18 months now. We have my committee has about 1,200 hours into this. Because this is not something you have to be a member to use. Mm-hmm. It's not something that you have to own to use. It's not something that if I use it, you can't use it. It is a public good. And as a public good, it's important to the entire state of Vermont and Danville. So we think we can raise 80% of the money we need from outside of Danville, not in Danville's budget, to restore this building. It is not inexpensive. It needs a lot of repair. It needs structural work. It needs drainage. It needs landscape. But we know in the passenger area, which I'd love to show you today, it's beautiful. It was built out in 1907 with this beautiful pine beaded board. It's going to be used by the Historic Society to put rotating historic exhibits of Danville, and by the Chamber of Commerce about where you can go and what you can do. Where are B&Bs and where's, you know, a place to go eat? And, by the way, where's Red Barn, the brewery down the street?
That's right.
Right? So it can fill this role of being a hub again. And everybody I talk to in Danville has real pride in what that station was and how it was part of the community. And we think it can come back again. Our timing is wonderful because the governor's program now on Vermont Outdoor Recreation has been funded. We just received a $98,000 grant for it. We've now raised $312,000 in grant money.
Wow.
Along with $50,000 of seed money out of the maintenance fund for the train station from the select board. So we think we're going to be pretty close in another, by the end of fall, to be getting close to shovel in the ground.
What is your final price tag? What is the amount you need to raise?
I'd love to know the answer to that question. Every time I say the number, it's wrong. But
you can give a range if you want. Or
well, we're going to solve this because tomorrow we hire the architect and engineering firm.
Okay.
The architect and engineering firm will give us pretty firm estimates by fall. My guess is that we're probably in a range somewhere between $450 and $550.
Okay.
But, you know, we got a good head start on that.
Yeah.
And we're still out doing the grant work. And, boy, thanks to the Agency of Commerce and Development, Vermont Housing and Conservation Board, Preservation Trust of Vermont, Sensibar, Freeman, Green Mountain Power, they've really been supporting us and saying we can see the vision. We'll fund you. Get it going.
Yeah.
That's wonderful.
Have you looked at what you've seen? Like, I've seen, like, in Randolph, North Bennington, what they've done with train stations there, you know, and to kind of show people, look, we can do something like that here in Danville.
Absolutely. And both of the two architectural firms that we're meeting on tomorrow to pick the one, could deliver a beautiful restored building that's repurposed to do what we want. And the really intriguing thing that we're wrestling with is we had this great big freight room, and there's nothing there. It's just a box that used to fill it with goods and services.
Mm-hmm.
As to how we can put that to work, you know, whether it's youth build, whether it's wellness, whether it's getting people to change their behavior patterns. And maybe we start with young people because they can change their patterns. I'm not sure about us.
Good point.
You know? So, I mean, I think it can just move quickly. And once we get the shovel in the ground, our guess is the end of 2023, we'll be having a big celebration.
Oh,
there.
How exciting.
Yeah.
Michael, what is it about train stations? I see old ones. Even if they're dilapidated, I think, boy, I wish that was restored.
Yeah.
I'd live in that. What is it about that building? They're hard by the railroad tracks, in this case, the rail trail. But that really kind of inspires a certain love, a certain romance.
Well, I think you can't look at it without thinking of the train. And the train and the train going by, the engineer waving out the window as they always did, the blowing of the horn. It's just an event out of history that's welcoming. It's not like dealing with Ukraine. This is dealing with a happy time.
Right.
And the stories, you can't be around trains without stories, and some of those stories are happy stories. Mm-hmm. We happen to have a beautiful bell off the steam engine that went off the rail and down into the creek. Unfortunately, it killed the fireman and the engineer. But the farmer found it. It was in 100 years later, it showed up in the creek because the creek had a washout.
Oh, my goodness.
And it's going to be in there. So we ring the bell and bring the train through.
That's exciting. Yeah. Michael Hogue is a member of the Danville Train Station Committee. Michael, if someone wanted to get involved or help out, where would they go? How would they contact you?
You can reach me through the town office.
Okay.
It's also, we're up on the website. You have to kind of work down through the planning committee, but you'll see all of our agendas, all of our minutes, all of our contact points, and we meet every month.
All right.
And we'd love to have some more help.
Oh, that's great.
And Michael. money.
Of course. I want to thank you for joining us today. Best of luck with this.
Thank you.
All right. One more break, and then we're going to check back with Jenny Rayfuse of the Hastings store here at Joe's Pond. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint and the Hastings store in West Danville at Joe's Pond. We've had a wonderful morning getting to know Danville and Joe's Pond better, and it's time to check back in with our host, Jenny Rayfuse, owner of the Hastings store, to make sure that I haven't been barred from the store for the rest of my time in Vermont. Jenny, welcome back.
Welcome back. You're always welcome here.
Oh, good. You're like the mayor of Joe's Pond, I've noticed this morning, aren't you?
I don't know if I'd use the word mayor, but yeah.
Okay, queen.
Queen. Yeah, I could do queen.
But it seems like a lot gets done here in the course of a morning at the Hastings store.
Oh, yeah. The only thing you've missed is a wedding.
Have you had one here?
Since my mom passed away, I became a justice of the peace, so we've had three weddings here in the last 2 years.
Oh, that is fantastic.
Yeah.
Oh, I love it. I've had to mail a few things here and get out of the way while people were checking on their boxes. The one thing we should talk about is the roof. We've got some roofers up there now, but something happened up there. What went on? A big windstorm?
Big windstorm last Tuesday. I got a message from one of my buddies who drives a tow truck, and he wanted to know if we were having roof problems, and I told him I didn't know what you were talking about, and came down, and he was sitting across the road in his truck, and the roof was completely rolled up like a fruit roll-up.
Yeah, so there's still wood up there, there's still tar paper, but the metal on top
just peeled right up.
Yeah, just rolled like a sardine can.
Yeah,
right?
So we got BD Roofing from Washington. They're coming over here and fixing everything, make it look back to normal.
All right, that's good. Everything. Don't worry, folks, if you've driven by the Hastings store and noticed that, it's going just fine there. Now, Hastings store is the epicenter for ice out on Joe's Pond. So, again, let's tell people what that's all about, what it means, what an ice out is, how, you know, when it gets set up, and how they can enter to win the big prize.
Okay, so like I said, there's a wood pallet with a cement block on it attached to a clock on shore. When the brick goes through the ice, pulls the electric, stops the clock, and whoever gets closest to the date and time gets half of whatever the jackpot is. And the other half goes to the Joe's Pond Association for their activities fund, which is mostly for our fireworks this year. So you can buy tickets here. You can buy tickets online. A few of the other stores in town have tickets for sale, as well as people throughout the community, Barrie, Montpelier, St. Johnsbury. We give out bunches of them so that people know that so-and-so has them, let's go to him, he'll get us some more, whatever you need.
Now, people get to pick their own time, date and time.
Yep.
So there could conceivably be a tie.
Does that ever happen? We've had several years where there have been multiple winners, and they just take
half of the half
or whatever. Yeah.
Is there anybody who is kind of the Tom Brady of ice out, the Babe Ruth, the person who kind of, it's like, oh gosh, you know, Bill is entered and he picks it, you know, two out of 10 years at least, or half the time he gets it.
In the 40 years I've been around.
Yeah.
No.
No. No one's become an expert on it.
No. They've come close, but nothing finite.
Yeah. Is there anything you can tell us about what's happening out on the pond this winter? Has it been is the ice thicker? The ice fishermen, having to go through more ice, less ice than normal?
Well, I think all the shanties at this point have been pulled off the pond.
Okay.
So, for the most part, ice fishing is over. So, I don't know how much. 2 weeks ago, we had 33 inches of ice. Of course, I don't know how much. I'm not going to go out and check for you.
Yeah. I don't want to be responsible.
I'm going to be bold and say I'm guessing there's less than 33 inches.
Okay. Well done. You've learned tact as the queen of
right.
Joe's Pond.
Right.
And I really, all right, so it's $1 per chance, and
yep.
The winner will receive half after expenses, and then the rest goes to the Joe's Pond Association for their entertainment, which is mainly the wonderful 4th of July celebration. And talk about what happens around here. You said the population triples. What's the summer like here at Joe's Pond and at the Hastings store?
So it's really, in the last 2 years, gone back to how it was when I was a kid. People are coming up earlier in May and staying through the entire summer and kind of, I don't know, they're like old home day. They come up and then they're here and they become one of the community again.
Yeah.
Not just coming and going, coming and going, coming and going.
A little less transient. Yeah.
Very much so. So we get to know the kids and the grandkids and they come down, they walk down from camp, they have a charge account here so they can get their ice cream, and Nana and Grandpa don't have to give them $1 here and $5 there. We also do a program with the kids in the summer under the age of 16. If they bring in a picture of them catching a fish, the fish has to be bigger than my hand if they're over 12, bigger than the kid's hand if they're under 12. They get a free ice cream cone.
We're just
trying to promote outdoor activities so that, they don't get carpal thumb.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Now, do you have Hershey's?
We do.
Which is what I grew up with back in Pennsylvania. You got the Hershey's ice cream.
We got the Hershey's ice cream.
Right. Do you do creamies at all or no?
No.
Okay.
Just old-fashioned hard scoop ice cream.
Love it. That's great. Let's talk a little bit more about Ice Out. You got to get these in by April 1st, right?
Correct.
All right. So if someone's from away, they can...
They can mail them as long as it's post-stamped April 1st. So that means not just drop it in the mailbox. You actually have to have a postal employee date stamp April 1st on your envelope.
All right. I'm a postal employee this morning. I'm here at the post office. And do you run the post office as well? Are you the postmaster?
No. The last postmaster was my dad.
Yeah,
He was just over 41 years.
Mm-hmm.
My grandfather before that, his parents before that. I did do an 18-month stint in Peacham and decided to go back to nursing.
This isn't just the only thing you do here.
No, I'm a registered nurse.
No kidding.
Yeah.
How many hours a week are you involved with nursing?
I usually work 3 days a week, 8 to 10 hour days. I do home health and hospice with Caledonia County Home Health.
Oh,
hey,
fantastic.
Ladies.
Oh.
And then the rest of the time I'm here.
Wow. Do you sleep?
Very well. Short yeah. periods of time, but very well.
Oh, I know that. Wow, that is absolutely phenomenal. And then... I know the summer gets very busy. How about leaf peeping season? Do tour buses come on in?
We haven't had very many the last few years.
Oh, right.
However, growing up, we used to have a huge influx of French Canadian, which was helpful because my mom was fluent in French, which was super helpful. I, however, apparently skipped the bilingual gene.
Oh, no.
So my 13-year-old is actually really well-versed in French. She picks it up real easy. So she's going to be the new translator. She doesn't know it yet, but she wants to start paying for things, and she's going to start working.
When those buses full of Quebecois come back in,
she can make it happen.
Oh, that's fantastic. Hey, one more time, we got to talk about the pies. It is Pie Day here at Hastings Store. So what kind of pies are available?
So in 30 minutes. They'll be coming out of the oven. We've got cherry, mixed berry, apple, raspberry, blueberry, and mixed berry rhubarb.
I'm in the way right now, where I'm set up. If we don't get this down in 30 minutes, I'm going to have some angry Danvillians.
Oh, that's all right. They'll smell it outside, and they'll just get them right out of the oven. And then we're off to make peanut butter cookies, so that's the next stop on the cooking train today.
And then there's donuts. People love the donuts here.
Donuts, cookies, banana breads.
Oh, that is so great. You seem to really love this, though.
It's my relaxation here.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. And you do seem calm, you know, and there's so much going on. This morning you've had to twice come over and be on the radio, and it does not faze you.
No. I just, you know, go with the flow.
Well, you do it quite well. And
thank
I
you.
Really appreciate that you've had us here this morning. This
anytime.
All right. Jenny Rafuse is the owner of the Hastings store in West Danville at Joe's Pond. Thanks so much for the hospitality. And, boy, it has been great to get to know Danville this morning.
Well, thanks for coming down and getting to know us.
All right. That is our show. Listeners, feel free to suggest guests or topics or a place you think we should broadcast from during WDEV's 90th anniversary. You can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Next stop is in a couple weeks. It'll be the Shaw's General Store in Stowe. And you can listen to past episodes of Vermont Viewpoint by downloading our podcast at wdevradio.com. Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre is up next. I'm Rick Sagary. Tomorrow on the show, I'll speak with Bob Ney and artist Natasha Bulger, and we'll learn about the importance of milkweed. We'll also talk about Chef Frank Pace and with Black Flannel Chef Christian Cruz.